The Remembrance Poppy. Born in a moment of poetic beauty found somehow amidst the muck and grime of the trenches. Championed by two heroic women as a means of raising money for veterans, widows, and orphans. The heart and soul of memorial celebrations in England and many of its former colonies a century later. And yet...
Dear Madam, Miss Michael has asked us to write you this letter, acknowledging receipt of your letter of February 9th, 1941, enclosing your synopsis. Miss Michael wished to use quotations from your letters and published articles, which were sent to her by you and your secretaries in 1921 to 1924, in order to make a complete chronological narrative of events. But as she can no doubt dispense with the use of these, it occurs to us that what is most important is that you accede to Miss Michael without controversy the facts which are proven beyond doubt by the documents she has, copies of which she would be glad to send to someone in New York for your inspection. Miss Michael originated the Flanders Field Memorial Poppy idea, and we feel sure that you cannot fail to concede that once you have examined the many documents in her possession. I beg to remain very respectfully, Tolness and Middlebrooks.
This is the story of two poppy ladies, each believing themselves to be the true poppy lady, one of whom couldn't even call the other by name in her autobiography. It's also the story of art transforming into something alarming and new in the furnace of war. And it's the story of the poppy enchanting me with its symbolic beauty, its simplicity, its elegance, but also scaring me a little too. I'm Charles Gustine, and this is Iconography, a podcast dedicated to the geography of icons, real and imagined. Today's icon is unmissable if you're in the United Kingdom in November, but it is not an icon exclusive to the UK. It's a symbol across the Commonwealth. In New Zealand, poppies come out on April 25th, Anzac Day, which celebrates the anniversary of Gallipoli. And Canadians relish the poppy with a particular hometown pride, since it was a Canadian colonel, John McCrae, who wrote the poem In Flanders Fields that transformed the poppy into a symbol of fallen soldiers reaching back out to us, imploring us to remember why they fought and died.
In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow. Between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky, the larks, still bravely singing, fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago, we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders Fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you, from failing hands, we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If you break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders Fields.
So I'm in the literal shadow of the Shard right now.
If you've heard episode one of the podcast, you might recall that I visited Guy's Hospital campus of King's College to see a relic from old London Bridge.
We have here an alcove from the medieval bridge. There's a little sign here, the London Bridge niche, purchased by Guy's Hospital for 10 guineas.
Right under the plaque that told me when Guy's had bought the alcove, there was this poster for an upcoming Remembrance Day service. And this was right around Guy Fawkes Day / night, and since I still actually find it a bit hard to believe that the holiday celebrating the fact that a rebel didn't blow up Parliament is officially named after the rebel that tried to blow up Parliament, I thought, oh, maybe Remembrance Day is the real name for Guy Fawkes Day, because, you know...
Remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder, treason, and plot.
Okay, yeah. Look, I'm going to endeavor to be honest with you when I don't know things or when I've thought some pretty silly things, because this podcast is all about learning more. Suffice it to say, Remembrance Day is not Guy Fawkes Day. I'm sure we'll get to Guy Fawkes someday. I'll be disappointed if we don't, but yeah, Guy Fawkes Day is Guy Fawkes Day, or night, or bonfire night. It goes by a lot of names, but Remembrance Day is not one of them. Remembrance Day is very much its own thing. What really struck me about this poster for Remembrance Services was a large red flower. Well, actually, it was more like an impressionistic red splotch with a black splotch in the middle, which really did a number on me on that white background. The flower was vaguely familiar, but why it was on this poster, what it had to do with remembrance? Yeah, no clue. And I basically left it at that, this tiny, niggling mystery. But then, I started seeing this flower everywhere, pinned to people's shirt fronts and lapels in all sorts of forms, real-looking, clothed silk, little metallic pins outlined in gold and silver. What was this? This was a very large club, and I had not been invited. And then, watching the BBC one morning, it became very, very clear exactly what the poppy meant to everyone in the club.
And in the middle of the street, the stark Portland stone of the cenotaph, that memorial built to commemorate more than 1 million British and Commonwealth servicemen killed in the First World War. A war which optimists believed would lead to years of peace. Vain hope.
Aha. So this was basically Britain's Veterans Day, celebrated on the Sunday nearest Armistice Day, the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918, when the Great War, the World War, came to an end. After 2 minutes of silence announced by the chimes of Westminster Abbey, representatives of every nation in the Commonwealth, as well as the royal family, the heads of all the parties, the past prime ministers, the mayor, they all laid wreaths of poppies at the base of the cenotaph between Big Ben and Trafalgar Square. Each one takes a moment before the monument, pausing in reflection, nodding at the cenotaph before turning away. A thank you. Afterwards, considering the simple power of the poppy, I thought about Colin Kaepernick, about how the San Francisco 49ers quarterback who sits in protest during the national anthem had to immediately defend himself from accusations that, by not standing, he was disrespecting our troops. The easy way to dismiss protesters, to question their dedication to the people who defend them.
The Niners quarterback, criticized by fans and on social media, saying he's dishonoring the flag and the military. Joining me now, we've got U.S. Army veteran Richard Allen Smith. Thank you so much.
And then I thought about the veterans and active servicemen who defended Kaepernick.
Well, I saw a lot of folks claiming that Colin Kaepernick was disrespecting troops or somehow disrespecting veterans with the protests that he's making. A lot of those people not having served themselves. And I think me and my colleagues who signed this letter really wanted to make sure that there was a voice out there saying, look, those people don't speak for us. There are many veterans that support both Colin Kaepernick's right to protest and also agree with him that Black Lives Matter and there's something that needs to be done in America about institutional racism.
I thought about the flag and the anthem, icons that had to represent both our military's actions as well as the First Amendment right to speak out against those actions. That's a lot of weight for a piece of fabric to hold. How could a symbol do both things without being torn in two? There's only or, patriotism or not, no and. Why couldn't we have one symbol that simply, purely, represented your appreciation of the troops' sacrifice? Then, one action, kneeling before the flag as a means of criticizing government incompetence and police brutality, could speak one powerful truth and a different action, wearing a poppy as a means of thanking and remembering and honoring, could speak a different powerful truth. Then, you know, if Colin Kaepernick stood on the 50-yard line on Sunday and spat upon remembrance poppies, yeah, then you could say for certain that he both does not support our government's policies and that he does not support our troops. As it stands, we might be asking too much of our flag. I was really quite taken with the poppy. I wanted this for America. Why didn't we think of it? Why don't we have this? Well, as it turns out, we did. And we still do. You are unlikely. It's not impossible, but you'd have to try. You're unlikely to see a bloom of artificial poppies in the two nations that gave us our poppy ladies, the two women who most fervently carried McCrae's torch after the war. France gave us Anna Guérin, and America, Melina Michael. No, not Moana. Melina. These two women spent the years after Armistice fiercely championing the poppy as a symbol of remembrance. Anna, a tireless fundraiser for French widows and orphans. Melina, a fervent believer, so struck by McCrae's poem that in 1918 she penned a response verse and promised to wear a poppy forevermore. Maybe it's because she publicly shared her story right as the U.S. joined another world war, but Melina got the stamp. She got the ship and the highway named after her, and she got the right to be the first, if not the only one, brought up when it's time for a poppy history lesson, even in countries where Anna, and only Anna, did all the work. Which is really a pity, because Anna, a truly extraordinary person, quite renowned in her time, is a shade of a memory now, with prominent histories incorrectly identifying her as a widow during the 1920s, which she was not, or whiffing on her date of death by 17 years. So, which woman deserves to be the true poppy lady? Melina and Anna would have definitely disagreed with me, but I don't think it's important to choose to elevate one's contributions over the others. It's important to relish the journey they took, to tell their stories and amazing stories that surrounded them, like, for example, the American Legion and VFW getting in a pissing contest over poppies and daisies. That'll be a fun one. These two women, largely forgotten today, embody the spirit of iconography. They saw the need for an icon where none existed, and they had the perfect candidate in mind, and they worked their asses off to help that icon live on long after they did. Still, people will always try to figure out who did the thing first. 20 days after Melina's death in 1944, the press's Memorial Day assignment was figure out who the real poppy lady should be.
The controversy continues over poppy originator. 24 years after the American Legion adopted the red poppy of Flanders as a memorial flower for the World War dead, a controversy still persists over who originated the idea. The Legion's records show on the eve of another Memorial Day that several women have sought recognition as the original poppy lady. All but three of the claims have been discounted. They are those of Miss Melina Michael of Athens, Georgia, who died May 10th at the age of 74, Madame A. Guérin of New York, a French woman who lectured in the United States at the outbreak of the war, and Mrs. Mary Hannessy, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, mother. Whoever may have conceived the idea first, there seems to be no argument that the inspiration for it came from poet John McCrae's famous lines, "In Flanders fields the poppies blow between the crosses row on row." Miss Michael, who fixed November 9, 1918 as the birth date of the Flanders Field Memorial poppy idea, said she largely was inspired by the poem. Madame Guérin, president of a French antique company in New York, said the idea came to her while she was reciting the poem in an address before the first convention of the Gold Star Mothers of Baltimore in 1919. "All at once," she recalled, "I realized that the Flanders Fields poppies were the symbol befitting the heroes of the war."
The war. I think it's worth it to pause right here for just a moment. Pause and think about the people of May 30th, 1944, themselves pausing to think about a war that they had all known by a different name not that many years ago. The Great War, or the World War. D-Day hasn't happened yet for these people in May of 1944. As the press tries to solve the decades-old Poppy Lady controversy, the landing at Omaha Beach is still a week away. So it's weird to think about it, but this is probably the last moment that people could look back at what we now call World War I, always that one appended as a reminder that there's a sequel, and it's bigger, and it's badder. They could look back without thinking, you know, funniest thing? I know a whole lot more about World War II than I know about World War I. It's sort of weird what's happened to World War I. It was epochal, a sea change, a complete disruption in the lives of many generations, one of which was capital L lost because of it. And yet, culturally, it has been completely overshadowed by its younger brother. I think the reasons for this are pretty obvious, and it all comes down to, well, iconography. World War II is simply easier to fit into the good versus evil mold we like so much. In retrospect, World War II seems like a wrestling match for the soul of humanity, between genocidal fascism on one side and everything good and right on the other. Of course, this is complicated by everything from the subsequent Cold War to, oh my gosh, Japanese internment, you guys. Oh God. But compared to World War I, which in retrospect seems like a pointless war fought because of convoluted alliances, it's made for movies. And it is made for movies over and over again. There are titans of World War II cinema, of course.
But what about us?
We'll always have Paris. We didn't have, we lost it until you came to Casablanca.
But even today, every year, new masterpieces are minted. Heck, there's an absolutely wrenching consideration of post-war fallout once a year, like Clockwork, Ida, and then Phoenix, then The Innocents. And none of these films even have Nazis in them. Nazis were the absolute pits of humanity. But Hollywood loves them. They're the gift that keeps on giving. Indiana Jones needed them to exist. No force during the 19-teens could compare. I hope beyond all hope that there will never be true story villains like them again. If you need villains, then World War I is actually undone by one of its greatest icons, Eric Maria Remarque's All Quiet on the Western Front.
You see, when you jumped in here, you were my enemy, and I was afraid of you. But you're just a man like me, and I killed you. Forgive me, comrade.
We are taught from a young age to consider the First World War from a German point of view. So, ultimately, we feel like there were no villains in that conflict, just senseless death. Even more than motive, we gravitate towards big figures and big moments. So, if you were to rank every major world leader from both world wars in order of how iconic they are, pretty much every leader from 1940 will come in over every leader from 1916. Wilhelm II, David Lloyd George, George Clemenceau, and Woodrow Wilson will simply never outflank Hitler, FDR, Churchill, Stalin, and Mussolini. I don't know whether they and their deeds, Kristallnacht, D-Day, the Blitz, Pearl Harbor, are really so much more iconic, or whether the ongoing discrepancy between cultural depictions of World War II and World War I has made them more iconic. But at this point, barring some Hamilton-like revival of David Lloyd George, there's no coming back from this deficit. So, considering that, I won't take it as a given that we all know the particulars of the Second Battle of Ypres, where Colonel McRae wrote the poem that changed the Poppy's fate. I certainly did not. Ypres was a medieval town in Flanders, which both then and today forms the northern Dutch-speaking part of Belgium. Flanders is a fascinating case of how Europe wasn't just a hot zone of contested territories during the World Wars. It's been like this for centuries, armies moving in and out like a risk board. Flanders, passed back and forth between empires and countries for centuries, formed its own Flemish identity, becoming an economic and artistic powerhouse in the Middle Ages. So, yeah, it's never particularly liked being part of anyone's compensation deal after a war, and it definitely didn't like being ordered around in French during World War I. The First Battle of Ypres in late 1914 had been a devastating stalemate for both sides, with neither gaining much ground and both losing thousands. The Allies stayed in Ypres, protecting what was, ironically considering how the residents felt about Belgium, the last piece of Belgium they had left. At the outset of the Second Battle of Ypres on April 22, 1915, something was immediately different. Anthony R. Hossack.
Plainly, something terrible was happening. What was it? Officers and staff officers, too, stood gazing at the scene, awestruck and dumbfounded. For in the northerly breeze, there came a pungent, nauseating smell that tickled the throat and made our eyes smart. The horses and men were still pouring down the road. Two or three men on a horse I saw, while over the field streamed mobs of infantry, the dusky warriors of French Africa. Away went their rifles, equipment, even their tunics, that they might run the faster. One man came stumbling through our lines. An officer of ours held him up with leveled revolver. "What's the matter, you bloody lot of cowards?" says he. The Zouave was frothing at the mouth, his eyes started from their sockets, and he fell, writhing, at the officer's feet.
This was the first successful use of deadly poison gas, chlorine in this case, in warfare. The Germans had tried it on Russians in January, but it froze. This was unprecedented, horrifying, a moment from which we could never return. The Germans were so unprepared for its terrible effectiveness in depleting opposition troops that they didn't even bring enough men to capitalize. They didn't want to advance because they weren't all that sure the gas had truly worked. It had. It was up to the Canadian Expeditionary Force to fill the gap and save Ypres. This is Canada, the British colony, by the way, with amateur soldiers sailing over to England to train for months in pitiable conditions, looked down on by experienced British troops as backwater bumpkins. Under the advisement of a chemist, they used urine to protect them from the gas, peeing into handkerchiefs and placing those over their noses and mouths. This is the world in which John McCrae wrote World War I's most famous poem. McCrae was a respected physician and professor, a strikingly handsome lifelong bachelor popular in Canadian society, a veteran of the Boer War, a devoutly religious man. On the morning of May 22nd, a young lieutenant named Alex Helmer, just 22, with a fiancée back home, actually a student at the university where John McCrae taught, someone who would have looked up to John. He was hit by a shell, and there was barely enough of Alex left to make a body-like shape in the bag they buried. The chaplain was away, so McCrae had to perform the service.
O God of spirits and of all flesh, who hast trampled down death and overthrown the devil, and given life unto thy world, do thou the same, Lord, give rest to the soul of thy departed servant Alexis Helmer in a place of brightness.
Lieutenant Helmer was killed at the guns.
A place of repose.
He was a nice boy. His diary's last words were, "It has quieted a little, and I should try to get a good sleep." His girl's picture had a hole right through it, and we buried it with him. I said the commitment service as well as I could, from memory. The soldier's death.
So this was one of those no-turning-back moments. The world had changed. Technology, warfare, and the next morning, as McCrae scrawled a poem on a page from his notebook while glancing up at Alex's grave, a cross surrounded by red poppies, Also, art. As with Hiroshima, as with the World Trade Center, there was before Ypres and after Ypres. From our vantage point in the future, the world before Ypres seems innocent, almost naive, for not knowing what was coming. No, they didn't think the war would be over by Christmas, a mere 5 months, as is so often said now. The Canadians' basic training took longer than that. But, I mean, come on, they had no way of knowing the World War would be what it ended up being. We have a tendency to reward those who thrived understanding the New World Order, while punishing those who basked in the glow of the old one, unaware their sun was setting. And so, as Lost Generation scribes like Hemingway with his terse prose and Joyce with his postmodernism block out the sun on the legacies of late Gilded Age writers like Theodore Dreiser and Willa Cather, so too do the war poets, some casualties of the war like McCrae, Wilfred Owen, and Isaac Rosenberg, others with titanic post-war careers like Siegfried Sassoon and Edmund Blunden. Those war poets inevitably see their work contrasted favorably with that of Rupert Brooke. Poor Rupert Brooke will always be the butt of this particular joke because he had the misfortune to write in 1914 about how the war had
wakened us from sleeping,
and that
if I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England.
And of course, that is exactly what happened to Brooke, who died of sepsis on the way to Gallipoli. And this anticlimactic death gets wielded against him when he's compared with the poets that died in the trenches, as if Brooke should have chosen a more poetic time to stop living. It even sounds so good to say he died before arriving at Gallipoli that it's frequently said he didn't ever see action. In fact, he did see action in 1914 before writing his famous war sonnets. But he's too easy a target. He, the hottest poet in England prior to the war, and according to W.B. Yeats, that went for his looks as well. He was
the handsomest young man in England.
He, all sentimentality, all patriotic fervor, all desire to die a young martyr shepherding the masses to early graves, versus the truth-tellers like Sassoon and Rosenberg, who dashed off intense, violent, unprecedented missives from the trench or the hospital bed on whatever scraps of paper were lying around. It's not a fair fight. So, to be fair to Rupert Brooke, I say let's hear what Winston Churchill had to say about him when he died, before he existed solely to be scoffed at.
The thoughts to which he gave expression in the very few incomparable war sonnets which he has left behind will be shared by many thousands of young men moving resolutely and blithely forward in this, the hardest, the cruelest, and the least rewarded of all the wars that men have fought. They are all history and revelation of Rupert Brooke himself.
As for McCrae, he was actually much more like Rupert Brooke than Siegfried Sassoon with his pitch-black satire.
You'd think to hear some people talk that lads go west with sobs and curses and sullen faces white as chalk hankering for wreaths and tombs and hearses. But they've been taught the way to do it, like Christian soldiers, not with haste, and shuddering groans, but passing through it with due regard for decent taste.
And he was much more like Brooke than the visceral Isaac Rosenberg.
What do you see in our eyes of the shrieking iron and flame hurled through still heavens? What quaver, what heart aghast? Poppies whose roots are in man's veins drop and are ever dropping. But mine in my ear is safe, just a little white with the dust.
No, McCrae is still a Georgian poet, flowers and birds. And in the sudden turn in the third stanza, it's not like he's turning new recruits to the army away. McCrae gets praise for writing from the perspective of the dead, but So did Brooke in one of his war sonnets.
Blow out, you bugles, over the rich dead. There's none of these so lonely and poor of old, but dying has made us rarer gifts than gold.
But McCrae didn't just record nature's beauty, he reflected perversions in nature. Birdsong drowned out by gunfire and the poppies that shouldn't have been there. See, poppies shouldn't have grown this abundantly in Belgium. But the skeletons of buildings and of soldiers were supplying the soil with calcium that poppies craved. It was unnatural nature. As for McCrae's dead, they sound haunting in their placidity, at least at first, with death a fact of life, a doctor's point of view. Brooke's dead, on the other hand, are inveighed with meaning through the very act of dying gloriously. There's no chance they'll be forgotten because the gods will take it from here, carrying them to Valhalla or some such place. McCrae knew what Brooke couldn't, as unfair as that is to Brooke, knew the horrors of poison gas, knew what Alex Helmer's anonymous grave looked like, just surrounded by poppies. The dead could be forgotten. Helmer could be forgotten. And so McCrae wrote a plea to the living to remember them.
On Saturday morning before armistice, during the 25th conference of the Overseas YMCA War Secretaries, November 9, 1918, a young soldier placed a copy of the November Ladies' Home Journal on my desk at headquarters. About 10:30 o'clock, when everyone was on duty elsewhere, I found time to read it and discovered the marked page which carried Colonel John McCrae's poem, We Shall Not Sleep, later named In Flanders Fields. It was vividly picturized, most strikingly illustrated in color. I read the poem, which I had read many times previously, and studied its graphic picturization. The last verse transfixed me. This was for me a full spiritual experience. It seemed as though the silent voices again were vocal, whispering in sighs of anxiety unto anguish. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields. Alone again, in a high moment of white resolve, I pledge to keep the faith, and always to wear a red poppy of Flanders fields as a sign of remembrance. I reached for a used yellow envelope, turned to the blank side up, and hastily scribbled my pledge to keep the faith with all who die. Oh, you who sleep in Flanders fields, sleep sweet to rise anew. We caught the torch you threw, and holding high, we keep the faith with all who died. We cherish, too, the poppy red that grows on fields.
By the time Melina Michael wrote her response, as conveyed here in her 1941 autobiography, The Miracle Flower, McCrae had been dead 10 months. He self-diagnosed himself with pneumonia, and he was right. Now he truly was the narrator of his poem. But through the last 2 years of his life, In Flanders Fields had been a very famous poem, both in the trenches among soldiers and back on the home front, where it was published in Punch magazine December 1915. Keep the home fires burning. Certainly, in 1918, Melina was struck in a way she'd never been struck, but it wasn't the first time she'd read In Flanders Fields, and it certainly wasn't the first time someone had thought to use poppies to memorialize fallen soldiers. As a matter of fact, McCrae's grave had been decorated by his comrades with a wreath of artificial poppies. But what Melina lacked in originality, after all, it was McCrae who came up with the poppy symbolism, she made up in dedication. She wasn't even done writing her poem when three men from the conference approached her desk, quite fortuitously, making a donation to thank her for gracious hosting. You know, things like the flowers she would purchase from her own pocket to spruce things up.
Looking up from my intense reverie of dedication, I replied, "How strange! I shall buy red poppies, 25 red poppies. I shall always wear red poppies, poppies of Flanders Fields. Do you know why? Then I showed them the illustrated poem of Colonel John McCrae.
Soon, everyone at the conference wanted poppies. New York was not ready for the demand. She couldn't find them anywhere. On the point of giving up, Mowena finally found artificial poppies at Wanamaker's, and the shop girl
was quite sympathetic, for her brother was then sleeping among the poppies behind the battle lines of France in a few months old soldier's grave. This personal contact with such a personal reaction further convinced me that this choice of a remembrance emblem for those sleeping in Flanders fields was no accident, but a logical one.
You will not find a woman more driven, more willing to take anything as a sign that her idea for these poppies was just and right and meant to be. She would make fetch happen, dadgummit.
Now what is it you want? A story of my life? Why, that is very kind of you to think of my life history worth mentioning. But I am always doing things like that. I have thousands of questions asked me every day. Why, I'm just like a little wren, just as simple can be. My sister once said to me, "Why, Becky, you are just too simple for words." That's why I remind myself of the little wren, just a simple little commonplace person. People will write the best things about me when I'm gone.
This is Mowena Michael being interviewed in 1939, 2 years before she writes her autobiography. She's 70, living alone on the fifth floor of the Georgian Hotel in Athens. Look, I'm a little unsure what to make of Mowena, even after all this research, because, I mean, think about what she just said. She fluctuates so radically between humility, "Oh, little old me, no," and the exact opposite of humility.
Just think what I have caused the world to realize from the sale of poppies each year. Just $70 million. Yet the world don't donate one penny toward my support, and I have had barely enough to buy actual necessities. I have a letter asking for donation toward the World's Fair. I think they ought to be ashamed of themselves as much as I have done already to ask me for cash. However, I am going to New York to give a talk sometime during the fair. I told them I wanted to make it to give my speech as near as Poppy Day as I possibly can. My expenses will be paid for that trip.
So we have to understand. Mowena, no matter what she may have said to the contrary, was thirsty for the recognition. Even in her 70s, she wanted to be the Poppy Lady, and for people to respect that title. And for the record, I don't think this is a character flaw at all. That tenacity kept her afloat through multiple setbacks and had her fashioning poppies and visiting very appreciative World War II wounded until her dying days. But it also meant she would market herself hard and use what advantages she had. Thunderstruck by inspiration, jotting down an impromptu poem in a perfect mirror of the moment in Flanders Fields was written, finding her magical shop girl. I mean, my gosh, if Poppy Lady was a patriotic superhero, Mowena Michael had the best possible origin story, and she knew it. Anna, on the other hand?
I met with a considerable difficulty. A Frenchwoman, Madame E. Guerin, took up the poppy cause for France and brought poppies to this country. The result was a competition for the disabled American veterans who were fashioning the poppies in government hospitals for 1 cent each. I proved that I was the first to originate the idea. She gave up her work here and later took her poppies, made by the French war widows, to Earl Haig in England.
That's Mowena's version. Now, let's fill in some gaps. When Anna Guerin brought poppies to the country, there were no American veterans making poppies. She didn't put a bunch of American amputees out of work. At that point, people were just finding poppies that already existed, buying them. The whole veterans making poppies thing was inspired by Anna's French widows. Also, Anna did not flee across the Atlantic, tail between her legs, upon seeing proof that Mowena had originated the poppy idea. She and her team proposed poppies to Earl Haig of England, as well as to Canada, New Zealand, Australia, all of it, before there was any controversy. and she was still around after her French widow's plan fell apart, convincing the veterans of foreign wars to take up the poppy. Anna was critical to the success of the poppy in America, and especially in the nations that still prominently use poppies. But Mowena is right about one thing. She probably did think of the idea first.
Johnny, get your gun, get your gun, get your gun.
So who was Mowena Michael when the idea formed, stripping away some of the origin story mythology? Well, for one thing, it was not Mowena's intent to be sprucing up the Overseas War Secretary's headquarters with flowers 2 days before Armistice Day. She had left her job as an academic and her life behind to go, you know, overseas.
Over there, over there, send the word over there.
But in spite of passing all the training, Mowena, at 49 years old, was deemed too old. I think she really wanted to do something important for the troops, and since she was unable to physically help them, she strove to find a gesture, some way to show obvious outward support. People liked her gesture. By December 4th, less than a month after she'd started, another training group in the YMCA had succumbed to the charms of the Flanders poppy.
My dear Miss Michael, this is to inform you that the 28th Conference of the Overseas YMCA Workers at their sessions adopted the poppy as the emblem of their organization. This was done in recognition of the brave men who gave their lives in devotion to a great cause on the fields of Flanders, where the poppies grow. It will be a constant reminder to us that we too must give our lives unsparingly in service. Wishing you success in the effort to have other organizations adopt this emblem.
9 days later,
this agreement made and entered into this 13th day of December 1918 between Mowena Michael of the city of Athens, state of Georgia, party of the first part, and Otho L. Ferris of the city of Portland, state of Oregon, and Mr. Lee Kedick of New York, state of New York.
Now Mowena Michael had a team of experts.
That whereas said Mowena Michael has composed a certain poem under the subject or caption of We Wear For You the Poppy Red, and has invented or designated certain ideas, the same relating to using the poppy as the symbol of victory, said Mowena Michael hereby assigns and transfers to said Ferris and Kedick.
Lee Kedick had a stable of prominent figures. Figures like war hero Colonel Billy Bishop, who could sell the heck out of Mowena's ideas at a Valentine's Day rally. Just one problem.
Poppy and torch banner now seen in Brooklyn. When Colonel William A. Bishop of Toronto, Canada, world's ace of aces, lectured at the Academy of Music Saturday night, a huge flag, the first of its kind ever seen in Brooklyn, hung above the stage. It displayed the emblem of the scarlet poppy and the torch, and at first, the large audience stared wonderingly at this banner with a strange device, speculating as to its significance.
The audience was kind of baffled by this new victory emblem. Was it patriotic? Was it remembering our troops or all the troops? Mowena and Kedick had done that thing where you get so excited about a great idea you've just had that you talk and talk and talk and you talk your way right out of why it was a great idea in the first place. The red poppy was still there, but now it was wrapped around Liberty's torch on an emblem with the colors of every allied nation. It was too complicated. Mowena would have some more small victories with it in early 1919, but Kedick soon lost interest. The victory emblem was not an icon destined to stand the test of time. Mowena had a crisis of faith, and by the time she got back on her feet, convincing the Georgia delegation of the newly formed American Legion to propose the poppy, not the victory emblem, but the poppy alone, at its national convention in Cleveland, Mowena's considerable difficulty, Anna Guerin, was ready to steal her spotlight. Outside of the obvious, their passion for the poppy, there are a lot of similarities between Mowena Michael, born in 1869 in Georgia, and Anna Guerin, born in 1878 in Vallon-Pont-d'Arc. Both were longtime schoolteachers, which probably gave them an intuitive sense of the power of simple icons. a holiday or ceremony with big characters and easy-to-draw symbols and engaging routines is going to catch on with young people and become a cherished tradition. And a complicated holiday, or conversely, one with nothing to really latch on to, well, that's simply going to be a day that people with the day off from work and school go to the beach. I really wish these two could have been friends, sisters in the poppy sisterhood. As it stands, it appears they were respectful acquaintances once they rose to prominence, rarely meeting, occasionally corresponding, often working towards a similar goal, and sometimes working at cross purposes, namely working for their own respective country's veterans. But then, in the last few years of Mowena's life, when she turned her focus to writing a memoir that would shore up her legacy as the sole creator of the Remembrance Poppy, things went downhill very fast. In a Hamilton-worthy exchange of letters, don't worry, I'll spare you the wrapping, the two laid their own individual claim to giving the world one of its most enduring, purest symbols.
Dear friends of long ago, so many things have happened since we corresponded back in the 1921 to 1924 era. The first duty in getting my house in final order is to write the history of the Memorial Poppy. This I have completed. The history could not be told without including in it how you helped broaden the horizon of the service of our sacred symbol. Therefore, I am writing to you and Madame Boo for permission to quote from your letters and articles to me back in those days when we were working so hard to educate the public in the meaning of the Memorial Poppy. Most sincerely, Mowena Michael.
You know, sounds courteous enough, but, as we've heard, and as Anna had heard, Mowena was not being so courteous about Anna's contributions outside of her letters. Anna feared that handing over her permission to use her words and name without first seeing what Mowena had said, well, that meant that she would be Poppy Lady's scrappy sidekick, or worse, just some French interloper. Anna panicked, quickly dashing off a harsh response and a full synopsis of her claim to creating Poppy Days.
Dear Miss Michael, I have just read your letter. I was out of town, and I cannot express my surprise. I am dumbfounded. No, please do not use my name or the name of my organizer, Mrs. Mark, until I know more about what you wish to write. You have written to me in France about your claiming to be the originator of the Flanders Poppy, but I thought it was a joke and I had not paid any notice. I shall have the history, my history, published before the next Decoration Day. I am, Miss Michael, very truly yours.
I have the honor to be your obedient servant.
Here's where things get sticky. In her synopsis, Anna claims she must surely be the originator of Poppy Days. Which may very well be true, though the long ago mentioned Mary Hennessy of Wisconsin may have beat her to that.
It is absolutely preposterous to think that there is two originators of the National Poppy Days, one for the United States and one for the Allied. The Flanders Fields Poppy Days started in the U.S. at Baltimore in 1919 after the first confession of the Ghost Time Mothers.
As we've seen, Mowena was interested in the poppy symbol and particularly her victory emblem, but while she took donations for flowers, the idea of selling flowers made by those affected by war on a specific Remembrance Day wasn't in the cards. In all likelihood, this still very popular conception was the work of Anna. However, in the letter that introduces the synopsis, Anna scoffs at the notion that Mowena might be the originator of the idea of the Flanders poppy itself. And here, she's on shakier ground. There's no doubt that Mowena wrote her poem before Anna started working with poppies. Later in life, Anna would claim to have come up with her poppy idea independently, but back before there was any beef, she happily claimed that she'd read Mowena's poem and that it had inspired her. When Mowena wrote her poem in 1918, Anna Guerin was a famous lecturer who had spent years touring Britain and America with praise heaped upon her in the newspaper of every town she visited. She had spoken before the royal family. She was at the American Legion National Convention in 1920 by invitation, a well-known commodity who had run many successful poppy days. Anna's lecture career had started after her 1907 divorce from her first husband, with whom she'd moved at age 19 to Madagascar, a brand spankin' new French colony, where she worked for over a decade as a schoolteacher. She had remarried to Eugène Guérin, an Alsatian justice of the peace, and while he worked in French Sudan, she began lecturing, focusing first on her time in Madagascar, because who wouldn't? But she soon made a career pivot.
There was a good attendance at Maynard School, Exeter, yesterday afternoon when Madame Guérin, officier d'instruction publique, lectured on Marie Antoinette. The whole of the proceedings were in the French tongue. Madame Guérin, who is a well-known character lecturer, wore a costume of the period, and her short but interesting recital of the important incidences in the tragic life of the French queen was listened to with great attention.
If she were alive today, she would totally be making a podcast like this, and she would definitely do all the voices. It was in this capacity that Anna became famous enough to travel overseas and lecture as Marie Antoinette and Joan of Arc in America just as the war broke out. In her synopsis, she writes,
I came in New York on the 9th of October, 1914, on the Lusitania as a lecturer. As the U.S. were neutral, I could not call myself a war lecturer. But when the U.S. entered the war, I became a war lecturer and lectured for the Red Cross throughout the country. We were in the middle of the ocean when armistice was proclaimed. I thought that my work was over, but having visited the north of France, in front of the devastations, and seeing the pitiful state of the children in this devastated part of France, we formed a committee called Protection of the Children of Devastated France. Monsieur Mirin, President of France, accepted to be president. Madame Mirin, his wife, being the active president. And I was chosen to take a place and to come back to the United States to lecture for the committee and to raise quickly as possible the 1 million francs for the committee so the poor children could be sent in South of France to recuperate their vitality.
When, at their 1920 National Convention, the American Legion agreed with the Georgia delegation and adopted the poppy as their emblem, it was decided that this organization, La Ligue Américaine Française d'Enfants, would make their poppies. On the wings of this success, Anna took her show on the road, sending deputies across the Commonwealth and personally visiting Canada, and then England, where she was pretty sure she could get the Prince of Wales on board since, you know, she knew the Prince of Wales. Field Marshal Douglas Haig, 1st Earl Haig, who came up with the name Remembrance Day, took to the poppy idea. He became co-chair of the poppy campaign with, she actually did it, the Prince of Wales, and he also became its poster boy. And the French connection was sold to the public as a blessing.
There is an added value to these poppies in the fact that they are made by the women and children in the devastated areas of France.
But behind the scenes, it was pretty clear that the British were only buying French poppies in 1921 because they didn't have time to make their own. In June of 1922, the Disabled Society's poppy factory opened in Britain. Now, it was imperative that Brits buy poppies stamped with Earl Haig's imprimatur, as these were the ones that supported British veterans. So, this was Anna Guerin's great mistake. Being French. She happened to be from the one country where the poppy just simply couldn't survive past 1921, past its fad stage. Because the French had a sentimental connection to another flower, la bleuette, the cornflower, which is what young French soldiers were known as thanks to their blue uniforms. And she would lose her other countries soon. It only took a few months for most countries to follow Britain's lead and say, hey, global unity is great and all that, but why are we supporting French widows and French orphans when we have our own problems? Leading that charge in America was, of course, Moena Michael.
We've done our bit for France. Why not let us make the poppies? Why not use poppy money to rehabilitate our own needy veterans and their needy families? Our children and wives need food, shelter, and clothes. Why not help us here at home?
Anna and Mowena may not have agreed about whose idea the remembrance poppy was, or about who should make them, but for one glorious moment, they were in total agreement about one thing. The folks at the American Legion had no clue what they were doing when it comes to flowers. Pretty soon the folks at the American Legion would agree with them. In September 1921, the American Legion Auxiliary agreed that American veterans should begin making poppies. Mowena did a little happy dance. But it wouldn't help to have so many poppies made if the poppy wasn't the American Legion's official flower. Worse, if there wasn't an official American Legion Poppy Day. And worse, if there wasn't an official American Legion Poppy Day. Inexplicably, to this day, it's still not exactly clear why, the American Legion as a whole decided in 1922, in spite of the massive success of poppy days around the world, to switch to the daisy. Mowena was furious. Are you ready for some Georgia smack talk? She said there was
no meaning, no symbolism, no appeal, no appropriateness in the daisy as a memorial symbol for my buddies sleeping in Flanders fields. There could be no symbol of the World War sacrifices but the poppy.
American Legion adjutant Lemuel Bowles responded,
my dear Miss Michael, we are very much interested in your letter and the clippings which you have enclosed. While I am personally delighted with the sentiments expressed in your letter, yet the action of our convention cannot be changed at this time. I am very glad to know of the services you rendered during the war and of the work you are doing now, and I hope to have the pleasure of writing you a more cheerful letter at a later date. Sincerely yours, Lemuel Bowles, National Adjutant.
For her part, Anna Guérin, who had actually met with Bowles and received his assurance that the choice of the daisy would not interfere with American Legion Poppy Days, well, she picked herself up and tried again. As she wrote in a 1922 letter to Mowena that is, thankfully, downright convivial,
my deception was great on the 23rd January to hear that the American Legion Auxiliary had not taken the idea to sponsor for themselves the National Poppy Day of the U.S. So, I'm just going to ask another exogenous organization to do it. Or the country would be for us and with us anyway.
That other ex-soldiers organization ended up being the Veterans of Foreign Wars of the United States, the VFW, 2 decades the senior to the very young American Legion. The VFW decided to give Poppy Day a try on Memorial Day, and they really liked the results. Soon after, they voted to adopt the poppy as their flower, which, you know, seems fair since no other American Veterans Association was using it anymore. Well, as it turns out, the American Legion were also rather taken with the VW's success. They wanted their flower back. They accused the VFW of stealing. No joke. They said the VFW does not
represent in any appreciable degree the veterans of Flanders Fields.
Oh, snap. So, Norman Hall, editor of the VFW's Foreign Service magazine, I repeat, Foreign Service magazine, basically snapped back, check the title, you guys. Where do you think Flanders is? Montana?
Members of the VFW are vastly more representative of the veterans of Flanders Fields than the Legion is.
He accused the American Legion of
attempts to gather undeserved praise and unearned funds by besmirching an organization that has added more glorious pages to American history than the American Legion ever will.
Mic drop. With that sort of smackdown, the Legion couldn't help but look like losers when they inevitably took the poppy back, even after the president had expressed his support for the VFW. There's something about the poppy that breeds this two men enter, one man leaves mentality. It's a supposedly non-nationalistic symbol that nobly stands in, poetically stands in, for all the troops who fought and died. In Ypres, for instance, where French soldiers, British soldiers, soldiers from their colonies, they suffered the effects of chlorine gas together. But having the option to wear something that so directly corresponds to your warriors, that tells people how much you love them, it seems to create this patriotic fervor, this frothing, jingoistic need to say, I love them more. I love them the best. We've seen it with Anna and Moina. We've seen it with the Legion and the VFW. And the more I've researched it, the more I see. You can see it everywhere in Britain today.
Some are questioning if we are being pressured into wearing what should be a symbol of our freedom. Ian, no poppy, why?
No, I've worn it before and I'll probably wear it again sometime. However, very slowly, something quite pernicious is happening to the way that we wear the poppy. This thing that was our act of remembrance, our way of thinking about the sacrifices that our grandparents, our parents made, is being hijacked. Elements of the right-wing press, anti-immigration groups, trying to put pressure on people, especially the Muslim community. You wear this now, and it doesn't mean remembrance anymore. It now increasingly means prove your loyalty to the country. And until that's over, I don't feel very comfortable wearing it myself.
Irish footballer James McLean disagrees with that sentiment. He finds himself in a Colin Kaepernick-like furor every November when every Premier League player but him wears poppy patches on their kits. According to Vice Sports UK,
if anyone has reasons not to wear a poppy, it's McLean, who hails from Derry, where 14 unarmed civilians were killed by the British military on Bloody Sunday. The player himself has sought to explain his decision by speaking to the West Brom official programme. If the poppy was simply about World War I and two victims alone, wear it without a problem, said McLean. I would wear it every day of the year, if that was the thing it stands for. But it doesn't. It stands for all the conflicts that Britain has been involved in. Because of the history where I come from in Derry, I cannot wear something that represents that.
You see, representation is interpretation. But we don't like to deal with interpretations that are too complicated. This year, more white poppies, which represent pacifism, were sold than ever before. White poppies are controversial. Margaret Thatcher did not like them one bit. Because they... well, they complicate the notion of the poppy. They are inherently of two minds, supporting soldiers while disagreeing with the thing that soldiers do. Which elicits the obvious response, why can't you just love our troops and shut up about your opinions on war? This is a dichotomy America has obviously never been great with. If the poppy were a thing in America, not that you can't find poppies, the VFW still makes buddy poppies to this day, but if you were expected to wear them, I can't imagine what that would be like. They may spare our flag and our anthem some undue stress, though, let's face it, they wouldn't. Trump would still say flag burners should lose their citizenship. But in a country still smarting from the scars of three unpopular wars, the Iraq War, the Vietnam War, and the granddaddy of them all, the Civil War, and don't you dare act like that wouldn't factor in somehow, even though it predates World War I. With all that baggage, the poppy would never be able to just... be. And, you know, maybe it shouldn't. Icons can only go so far. On an elemental level, I really love what the poppy represents. And I think it's design genius. I love that it can be abstracted to a red splotch with a black splotch in it, and you still get it. It's as catchy as an image can be. But you have to watch your back with something that catchy. Strapping a poppy to your lapel, that says just one thing. I remember. But we are humans. Complex messes of emotions, synapses firing constantly. We say 1,000 things, and we're capable of holding hundreds of contradictory beliefs about anything and everything. An icon should never completely take the place of expressing all those other things, of having that conversation. Because if an icon ever becomes so accepted that you have to use it, that it's enforced, and don't act like that's never happened before, well, there's bound to be a war fought over that. Which, when it comes to the poppy, would be one really cruel irony. Thanks for listening to episode 2 of Iconography. I don't expect future episodes to be quite as long as this one, but I really hope you guys enjoyed spending time with Melina and Anna as much as I did. They were a complete and total surprise to me, and I felt like I had to do them justice. Speaking of which, thank you so much to our incredible Anna, Rachel Mitras, and to our incredible Melina, my fiancé, Carolyn Ballard. Iconography is written, produced, and edited by Charles Gustine. That's me. If you have any suggestions for juicy icons, drop by our Facebook page, facebook.com/iconographypodcast, or our website, iconographypodcast.com. Or hit me up on Twitter, at Charles Gustine, CharlesGustine. If you like what you heard, be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and be sure to leave a rating and review. It really helps to get the word out. Next time, it's Christmas. It had to be Ebenezer Scrooge.